Massachusetts is ordering the world's largest retailer to carry emergency contraception at its 44 Walmarts and 4 Sam's Club stores in the state. We're talking about the morning after pill. Massachusetts now the second state to make Walmart do this behind Illinois. Walmart says it will comply with the ruling and review its nationwide policy on the drug. Walmart had said it chooses not to carry many products for business reasons, but would not elaborate. But now that pill will be available across the board in the state of Massachusetts.
All right, that's from CNN. They're reporting the big news about Walmart complying with the state's request, demand that they carry the morning after pill. I imagine that this is going to be a story that will unfold state by state until we really have to come to some understanding about who's going to carry it, why they should carry it. Very interesting. Tucker Carlson on MSNBC interviewed one of the women and her lawyer who sued in Massachusetts to have Walmart carry the morning after pill. And we're going to hear that piece in just a moment here in the first half hour of Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're coming to you live this Thursday on Issues Etc. It is, what is it already, the 16th of February. Later in the program, Dr. Ron Rhodes will be our guest. We'll spend about an hour with him from 3:30 till 4:30 talking about witnessing and answering the objections of atheists, agnostics, skeptics. You know, those three are three different things, although they can overlap. We'll start out our conversation with him defining each one of those. Then spend a half hour with Dr. Martin Noland. Today the church remembers, well, I should say the Reformation side of the church remembers the lesser-known reformer. Right next to Martin Luther is his longtime friend and colleague and author of much of what makes Lutheranism Lutheran, 16th century reformer Philip Melanchthon. We'll talk about him with Dr. Marty Noland there for that half hour until the third hour of the program. And in the third hour, as promised, Terry Mattingly will be our guest. We're going to talk about religion and pop culture. Terry comes from Scripps Howard News Service. We'll be talking about the influence of pop culture on religion, but also how religion, in particular Christianity, is portrayed in pop culture. It's really all over the place. That's the lineup for today. Our call-in numbers here in the first half hour, 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. It's open lines. We're going to hear from Tucker Carlson in his interview with this woman and her lawyer. They were key in getting Walmart to comply and to carry the morning after pill. Bit of a debate there. We'll let you hear that, and I want your reaction as well. Illinois has already had its share of this when it comes to Walgreens. And what comes next after they're forced to carry it? Well, the pharmacists might object. And if Illinois is any indication, the pharmacist's right to conscience at that point usually gets ignored. Our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. It's open lines, issues, etc. Concordia Theological Seminary underwrites Issues Etc., and they are offering this summer nationwide, and when I say nationwide, I mean really all over the nation in many venues, some continuing education opportunities for both lay people and for pastors. They're going to be all over the country offering these things. This means they send out their best to you, and you have an opportunity to avail yourself of these continuing education opportunities. For more information about Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, and these continuing education opportunities nationwide, call area code 260-452-2266. 260-452-2266. Or you can go to our website, issuesetc.org. Issuesetc.org. You'll find the logo for Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana, at our homepage. Tucker Carlson was very interested in the lawsuit that forced eventually Walmart to comply and carry the morning after pill in the state of Massachusetts. He spoke with one of the plaintiffs in that lawsuit. This is from Tucker Carlson and MSNBC.
Should the government really be telling businesses what products they can stock on their shelves? That's debatable, but it is happening. Walmart is ordered this week by the Massachusetts Board of Pharmacy to carry the morning after pill. It's an emergency contraceptive and a controversial one. The directive came after three women, backed by abortion rights groups, sued Walmart to carry the pill in its Massachusetts stores. Dr. Rebecca Gee is one of those women. She joins us from Boston tonight with her attorney, Sam Perkins. Dr. Gee, Mr. Perkins, thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having us on the show.
Dr. Gee, why should government be telling businesses what they can and cannot sell? Or why should government be forcing businesses to sell things they don't want to sell?
Well, Tucker, the emergency contraception pill is not like stocking Colgate versus Crest toothpaste. A pharmacy is a medical, it's part of the healthcare system. It's dispensing medications that are crucial to patient care. It's a prescription that a patient goes to a pharmacy with as part of a physician-patient contract, and a patient, when the patient goes to the pharmacy, expects to be able to get that medication. It's really part of the healthcare system, so I think
You say it's part of the physician-patient contract. You don't own Walmart. I mean, you're not, right? I mean, you don't have a business relationship with Walmart, I assume. It's Walmart is owned by its stockholders, and so why shouldn't they get to decide what Walmart sells? I guess I'm missing this.
You're absolutely right. What they sell on their shelves other than the pharmacy, but the pharmacy itself is critical to care of patients, whether they're stocking medications to treat diabetes or hypertension. When a woman walks into a pharmacy, she is getting a medication that she may need. And as you may know, emergency contraception is the sooner you take it, the more effective it is.
Now, before she goes on, she's tried to make a point, and she'll make it again in the course of this conversation with Tucker Carlson, that the morning after pill should be viewed like any other medication that a pharmacist dispenses. If you've got a cold, you expect, well, we were just over at the pharmacy earlier today, my wife and I. She's got a terrible cold, so we're looking for something. It's one of those things that because of all the meth labs, you got to go behind the counter, give them your firstborn child and all these kind of things before you can buy it and feel better. Well, we expect them to carry some brand of this medication, and if you go to the doctor and they say, here's a prescription, you expect them to be able to provide that in a reasonable fashion, right? But let's just say for the sake of argument, she's tried to say that the morning after pill is not, and she will again, that it is not an abortifacient. It can be. The real question, she's already raised it, is when you take it. It may not be an abortifacient if taken very early, but if taken later, as many women might, it is. So, is birth control medicine? I don't want to get into the debate about birth control, right or wrong, but is the pill, or the morning after pill in this case, which is just a huge, gargantuan dose of whatever's in the pill, is that medicine? I remember when President Bill Clinton was in office and he tried to make the case that RU486 was medicine. Not the same thing as the morning after pill. Let's keep that clear. But that is an abortifacient pill designed to induce a chemical abortion, RU486. But remember when they pushed and shoved it through the FDA in the latter years of the Clinton administration? And the president made a speech saying that medicine should be permitted by the FDA without reference to politics. And I asked at the time, is RU486 medicine? What is, let's just look at what medicine is. Medicine either treats symptoms, it either offers some kind of a cure, or it relieves pain. Does the morning after pill do any of those things? I mean, if you view the embryo as a symptom of an illness, I guess you could say it treats a symptom by getting rid of the symptom. But technically speaking, it's not a medicine. Not in that sense. Not in the way people think about, I'm going to the pharmacist to get something that's either going to make me feel better or treat an ongoing chronic condition that I have or make these symptoms go away. It is a drug. It's something else than medicine. So she's trying to make the point that it's just like any other medication, when in fact, I don't even want to allow her premise that this is medicine. This isn't the same as going to get your blood pressure medicine or your glucophage or your water pills or your nerve pill. It's not the same. Because pregnancy is not an illness or a symptom. of an illness.
And time is of the essence. And so if a woman goes to a pharmacy and is refused that medication, it may not be effective if she has to go pharmacy shopping.
I'm absolutely certain that's right, but she can go somewhere else and buy it, or she can't. But the fact is that it's not up to her what Walmart sells. I want to get you, Mr. Perkins, in on this. How is it that you get to choose what a store sells? I mean, you could make the same argument about grocery stores. I need to eat to live, right? But I'm not allowed to tell a grocery store what it has to sell, and neither is government, yet.
Well, I think as Rebecca said, Tucker, this is a little different. You know, if Bloomingdale's decided that it didn't like the comments you made on your show, so all of a sudden it stopped stocking bow ties, that would be one thing that they had the right to do. But we're talking about something that is an integral part of the health care system. And
as defined by whom? Wait, hold on.
And also from the doctor's point of view, okay. For someone to say when a doctor has prescribed emergency contraception to a woman who may be at risk of having a baby that is unintended, that's the equivalent, if you won't give her that prescription at the time she needs it on an emergency basis, of turning someone away from an emergency room.
Okay, it isn't. It isn't, because she's not going to die. You turn someone away from an emergency room and they're going to bleed to death. Or they're going to lapse into a coma, or they're going to choke to death. Whatever they come to the emergency room for, their life is in danger. That's why they call them emergency rooms. Pregnancy doesn't kill anybody. She's not going to die. It's not the same as turning her away from an emergency room. And you notice, very clever lawyer, in simply assuming that contraception, or, in the case of the morning after pill, a potential abortifacient, is an integral part of the medical system. That's what he said, an integral part of the medical system. Since when? And it didn't get responded to, but Tucker Carlson very wisely interjected, says who? According to who is it an integral part of the medical system? For that matter, why can't I walk in and say, look, for me, pot is an integral part of my medical treatment. I like weed. So when I go to Walmart, it's integral to treating me. My what? My boredom? Whatever. It's part of my medical regime to smoke a little weed every day. So, Walmart, why aren't you carrying my weed? At low, low prices. Always. We have to back up and make clear what is medicine, what isn't. What is this pill supposed to treat? Is there some sort of emergency here? They call it emergency contraception. What makes it an emergency? Her life is not in danger. She might feel it's an emergency, but that's different. You know, I could show up at the emergency room and say, I have an emergency. I have an emergency. What is it? I have to go to the bathroom. Let me use your bathroom. They'd say, go down the hall to the up. No. This is an emergency room, and I have an emergency. We're working with two different definitions of emergency, aren't we? Let's talk with a few of you before we go on with Tucker Carlson's interview. Let's go first to Steve calling from his car. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Todd. How you doing?
Very well. Well,
you missed some intense hail up here in North County.
Oh, really?
I haven't gotten it hailed for probably 30 minutes straight.
Okay, just don't send it down here because my car's sitting
won't.
In the parking lot.
Sounded like a drum roll on my car. There was no place to hide. lady seemed to be making in her statement, that opening statement there that you played, all sorts of premises that she just kind of rattled off that, like the one you just brought up about what is it medicine. I mean, there, if you examine each of her arguments that she'd rattled off so quickly, many of them would, I think, bear further questioning. And I'm just wondering that based on her logic, maybe what do you think? It sounds like based on her reasoning that the patient could also force a doctor to write her a prescription for this drug.
That might be next.
She used this phrase, the doctor-patient contract, that she's assuming that the pharmacy is part of.
You know, it's a two-edged sword, too, Steve. You're very right. I mean, it might be next that doctors are being sued as individuals for not being willing to prescribe these things. And the same argument will be made, find another doctor who will. Now, here's the two-edged sword. She insists that the pharmacist is part of the medical chain, the chain of medical care. She insists that it's the basis of her plea with Walmart. Well, the doctor, at least at this point in time, the doctor is allowed what is called an objection on the basis of conscience. He can refuse to prescribe on the basis of his own conscience. It's against my religious beliefs, or I just don't like this drug, or I think it's dangerous, or something like that. He can prescribe whatever he wants to and not prescribe what he doesn't want to. He has that claim to conscience. Well, she says that the pharmacist is in that chain of medical care. So shouldn't the pharmacist, if he's the equivalent of a doctor in this case, have the same claim to conscience? Apparently not. But you can't have your cake and eat it, too. Joe is calling from his car. Hi, Joe.
Hi, Todd.
Hi, Joe.
My comment touches on what your last caller just said, but not only does a woman have a supposed right to a constitutional right to an abortion, but it sounds like they may have to go the next step and say she has a constitutional right to make someone help her do that, whether it's forcing a doctor to prescribe the medicine or whatever the situation might be. And I think that's the argument they're probably going to have to end up making, is that because she has a constitutional right to an abortion, people have to assist her in doing that.
Yeah, and I think, thank you very much for that. I think that that is because she can't do it herself. I'll tell you what this is about. You want to know what it's really about? This is smoke and this is mirrors. This is not about whether a pharmacist has to prescribe it or whether a doctor has to prescribe it. This is about getting this drug over the counter. This is about putting this drug out on the shelves. That's what it's about. They know that if they bring enough of these, and this is a nuisance lawsuit, if they bring enough of these nuisance lawsuits and get Walmart, its various patrons upset enough that they're carrying this, Walmart is going to do one of two things. It's going to either say, come on, we can't deal with the pharmacists, we can't deal with the legal problems, we're going to shut down the pharmacies. Now, they're not going to do that. There's too much money in it. So what will they do? Walmart will say, just let us carry it over the counter, and then everyone can make up their own mind. And we don't have to worry about this lawsuit and that lawsuit. We'll put it on the shelves, and everyone can make up their own mind. Buy it or not buy it. That's what this is about. That's where it's aimed. Ralph calls from Renault in Illinois. Hey, Ralph.
Hello there. And, yes, I was just calling. I've already been turned away from pharmacies or told that they don't have various medications in stock because they just don't get enough demand for them. And these were for conditions requiring immediate treatment or timely treatment, that actual physical problems.
And I think that's common, Ralph. Thank you for the call. I mentioned that we had been in the pharmacy at Walmart today, and there was a woman right next to us who was looking for one of her medications, her regularly prescribed medications, an elderly woman, and she was told, we don't carry that anymore. Not enough people want it, and so it's not worth our money to carry it. We don't carry that anymore. You know what the lady did? She said, do you know who does carry it? And the lady said, sure. And she told her, and she went and got it. All right, let's go back to Tucker Carlson's interview with this woman in Massachusetts who, among others in her lawsuits, have managed to get Walmart to put the morning after pill behind the counter and filling prescriptions for it.
Pharmacies
are not
like Bloomingdale.
With all due respect, what you're saying is rhetoric. I mean, the emergency contraception pill is not a pill that saves a woman's life. And moreover, and here's, I think, the crux of it, it's controversial. Some people believe this pill is immoral. This is tantamount to forcing people to perform abortions. Some people think abortion is fine.
I'd like to address that issue, because emergency contraception is just that. It's contraception. It works not through an abortive fashion. It's often confused with RU486, which is an abortion pill. But emergency contraception is the same medication that is in most common contraception. and works, as you may know, the same way that breastfeeding and other things
and
work as
you know what?
Preventing
I agree with
pregnancy.
You. I'm actually on your side in this. I don't have a problem with it. But some people do, and so you're missing my point. You and I may think it's fine. There's nothing wrong with it at all. But the fact is some people think it's immoral, and they have a right to believe it's immoral, and they have a right not to have their morals trampled upon by you simply because you disagree. In other words, you're forcing people to commit an act they believe is immoral. And I don't know why you're doing that.
Well, Tucker, as a matter of fact, I don't think that either Dr. Gee or I is forcing anyone to do anything.
Of course you are.
We're
you're using the power of the state of Massachusetts to make people sell something they don't want to sell.
In Massachusetts. Actually, no. Who's making them sell something they don't want to sell is the Board of Registration in Pharmacy, backed by the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. This is a regulated industry.
That's actually not true, Mr. Perkins, or you wouldn't be involved in this lawsuit, which is forcing. The state is, at this point, not enforcing it. You're trying to force the state to enforce it. And I'm really
saying that's not true, Tucker. The Board of Pharmacy unanimously voted because under Massachusetts state law, the pharmacies are required to stock medications that are commonly prescribed and needed by the community.
I'm aware of that.
And the Board of Pharmacy decided that this meets both those requirements and so is now requiring Walmart, not us, but the Board of Pharmacy, or the state of Massachusetts is requiring
right. You don't see that as authoritarian. I'm not going to use the word fascism, but you don't see it as authoritarian to force people to do something they believe is immoral. That's the point I'm making.
If you're talking about rhetoric, now you're getting into a little bit of rhetoric yourself.
It's true.
The fact of the matter is that there are regulated industries of every type. Hospital emergency rooms have to treat people. There's no way in the world that a corporation that's licensed by the state of Massachusetts to provide pharmacy services has the right to pick and choose what kinds of drugs in violation of state regulations it can do.
I think a person
who goes in who needs some sort of medication to help with HIV, it's not up to the pharmacy to tell them we're not going to prescribe, we're not going to stock this kind of medication.
Okay. That is so far off the topic that I can't believe that's the final word, but sadly we're out of time.
Actually,
so
it's right out of what we're talking
about. It's going to have to be, but I'm not going to allow you to continue with that completely distracting
rhetoric.
Well,
let
me explain
why it's not a distracting point at all.
I'm afraid we're out of time, but I appreciate the explaining you've done so far, and the same goes for you, Dr. Gee. Thanks a lot.
Okay, that's Tucker Carlson, MSNBC, his program called The Situation, talking with a doctor. She turns out to be a medical doctor, and her lawyer, who had brought the suit in Massachusetts to force Walmart to carry the morning after pill. They were successful. Now, a couple things. She made a point. My time is short. She made a point that the morning after pill works just like the pill. And she said it doesn't work through an abortifacient. And it's not an abortifacient. That depends on when you take it. If you take it, the minute you after you've had sex, chances are it will not act as an abortifacient. If you take it 2 days later, 3 days later, chances are much greater it will. Does it have an abortifacient in it? Again, that depends on when it is taken. It can either prevent conception, in which case it's a contraceptive, or it can also prevent implantation, in which case it is an abortifacient. I'm not an MD, and I know that. On the other thing, I think Tucker Carlson's point is well made. Who is forcing whose morality on whom? We'll be right back.
Talk radio for the thinking Christian. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
Many Christians today are reading the prophet Ezekiel in a rather odd way. They view this book as a roadmap for the end times, a chronology of what will happen when the nation of Israel is restored and the temple is rebuilt in Jerusalem. Is this what the prophet Ezekiel was really talking about? How can we find Christ in the book of Ezekiel? Our Issues, Etc. book of the month for February is a commentary on Ezekiel, the first 20 chapters. It's authored by noted Old Testament scholar Dr. Horace Hummel. Order the Concordia commentary on Ezekiel by calling Concordia Publishing House 1-800-325-3040. You can also browse before you buy. Just visit our website, issuesetc.org, and there on the homepage, you'll find the Issues, Etc. Book of the Month for February, the Concordia Commentary on Ezekiel, chapters 1 through 20. The book is $42.99 plus shipping and handling.
Now this Global Minute directs your prayers toward Afghanistan, where poor drinking water kills. A typical person in Afghanistan can expect to live no longer than to age 50. Unsanitary conditions and poor drinking water are the leading causes of early death in the country. You probably know that Afghanistan is off limits to Christians who carry traditional missionary visas, but health and education needs are pressing. Only about 25% of adults there are literate. Pray for Christians who want to go and serve to do so with humble hearts filled with Christ's love. The Islamic traditions are quite strong in Afghanistan, and anyone who would say they accepted Christ as their Savior would be banished from their family. Pray for the Christians who are already there to have wisdom in sharing Christ as they work in the tough cultural and political conditions. Learn about what Muslims believe and ways you can pray for them at missionvisionnetwork.org. That's missionvisionnetwork.org.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. A friend of mine gave me a book to read. What's this? I wondered when I saw the title, The Virgin of Bennington. It's Kathleen Norris's autobiographical account of her years at Bennington College and the beginning of her career as a poet in New York. She reflects on her experiences with drugs, with sex, reflects on them now as a committed Christian. She tells about a night she spent at an openly free sex and drug dealing hangout for young people. She says she was among other young people who, like me, were struggling with questions of identity, of acceptance and rejection. Some were eventually lost to drugs, others to the plague of AIDS. Some have survived. When I think of them, I summon the comment of the early church theologian Philo of Alexandria, who advised human beings to always be kind, for everyone you meet is fighting a great battle. Maybe all that calls up the fears that you might have for your own children, or maybe Kathleen Norris's experiences were your own. I'll be in Manhattan tomorrow, and I'll be passing hundreds of anonymous young people. They'll give the appearance of having it together. Do they? Are the young people you will meet today grounded in the teachings of God's love, or are they on the brink, fearfully holding on to life by only a thread? Be kind.
I'm Tom Baker, and I know many of you have been missing Law and Gospel on AM 850 KFUO, but we're going to be back on Ash Wednesday, March 1st at 6.05 p.m. And we have a new theme which you're going to be interested in hearing. I hope to visit with you then. In the meantime, you can visit me on my blog at lawgospel.com/blog.
You know, we often encounter people who will say, I don't believe in God. I encounter a lot of them via email and over the phone lines on this radio program. They don't believe in God. They're very upfront about it. They might say they're an agnostic. They might say that they're an atheist or perhaps just a, some of them have even said, hardened skeptic. We're going to talk about witnessing to atheists, agnostics, and skeptics here during this hour of Issues, etc. Dr. Ron Rhodes will join us. What's the difference between the three, an atheist, an agnostic, a skeptic? Does anyone really, really not believe in God? Is there something about, let's talk about hardened atheism. Is there something about atheism that presupposes God's existence? We're going to talk about that during this hour of Issues, etc. Dr. Ron Rhodes is a regular guest. He'll join us here in just a moment. You join us as well. Our call-in number, 1-800-730-2727. 1-800-730-2727. Listeners with the best questions or comments will get a copy of Dr. Rhodes' books. The book is Answering the Objections of Atheists, Agnostics, and Skeptics. 1-800-730-2727. We also have an in-studio email address. Feel free to use that here in real time. IssuesETC@KFUO.org. IssuesETC@KFUO.org. Dr. Ron Rhodes is a regular guest. He's president of Reasoning from the Scriptures Ministries. He's author of several books, including the book we're giving away during this hour, Answering the Objections of Atheists, Agnostics, and Skeptics. Ron, welcome back.
Well, thanks. It's good to be with you today.
You know, often when the debate begins or when the conversation begins, the atheist or the skeptic will assume that they occupy the intellectual high ground in their objections to Christianity. Is this true?
Well, that's a very good starting question. You know, it's very often posed as being a conflict between science and religion, or another way to put it is fact versus faith, as if Christianity is based entirely on faith, whereas the atheist has all the facts on his sides. And really, one of the reasons I wrote this book was to sort of counter that claim, because I do believe that Christianity is based upon evidence. It is based upon facts. And, you know, more and more scientists are actually turning to faith today. And just to give you a couple of quick examples, there are many people who are, you know, archaeologists, both Christian and non-Christian archaeologists, who have discovered scientific evidence that supports the veracity of the Bible. The intelligent design movement also involves scientific claims that supports the veracity of Christianity and the idea that the universe was created by an intelligent designer. You've got the second law of thermodynamics, which seems to indicate that the universe had a beginning, which is compatible with the Genesis account. So all I'm saying is that Christians are interested in evidence. And, you know, if the atheist, you know, claims to have the higher ground, my exhortation is let's look at the facts. Let's see what the facts really support. Let's look at the evidence. Let's look at the science. And it's my opinion that you'll come out on the side of Christianity if you're objective about it.
Let's delineate the differences. Sometimes they're subtle here, but sometimes they're not, between the atheist, the agnostic, and the skeptic. Give us a brief definition of each, and how, if any, do they overlap?
Well, the atheist is a person who does not believe in God, and it really comes from two Greek words. The prefix a means no, and then the word theos means God. So atheism means no God. The atheist is a person who does not believe in God or any kind of deity. By contrast, you've got the agnostic, who basically says that you cannot know or do not know whether God exists. And that comes from two Greek words as well. Again, a means no or without, and then the Greek word gnosis means knowledge. So literally it means no knowledge, but more specifically it refers to a person who claims that he is unsure or has no knowledge about the existence of God. And then finally you've got skeptics. And the root word for skeptic comes from the idea of doubting, hesitation, inquiring. A skeptic is a person who is very tentative in his or her beliefs, neither denying nor affirming God's existence, but is somewhere in the middle ground, is just, you know, he just doubts everything. It's got a philosophy of doubt that permeates everything that he does. Now, practically speaking, I should tell you that the arguments that atheists, agnostics, and skeptics use are typically the same kinds of arguments. So in that sense, they're very similar.
Now, let's start with the atheist, if we could.
Mm-hmm.
What is the most common objection that you have heard in your long career of both writing and speaking that you have heard from those who claim to be atheists?
Well, probably one of the most predominant claims is that the reality of evil in our world proves that there cannot be a good, benevolent, all-powerful deity. You know, they look at people dying from cancer, or they might look at children who get run over by a car. They look at the reality of Adolf Hitler, who killed millions of Jews, or they talk about the Twin Towers in New York. How could a good God exist and allow that kind of thing to happen? And that's probably one of the more common ones, and one that's not too far behind it is the idea of it's ridiculous to claim that the idea of a good God is compatible with the existence of a hell. You know, that a good God could send anybody to hell. You know, nobody who is good would do that. Certainly no human being would stoop so low as to do something like that. So how could you claim that there would be a deity that would do such a thing? So, again, I think those are probably two of the more common ones I come across.
I want to respond to both of those in the course of our conversation. But let's start with something very basic. It's really so basic, sometimes if you hear it, you think, wow, that's actually perhaps a solid objection. And I wonder what your answer is, Ron. Someone says, look, if God did exist, why wouldn't he make his existence incontrovertible? Why wouldn't he, say, make a regular appearance among us? Or give some undeniable evidence of his existence that everyone had access to so that no one would doubt that he is?
Well, that's a good question. In fact, very often atheists will come along and say, if God is real, why didn't he make his existence more overt and more clear? In fact, I believe it was Carl Sagan who said, why doesn't God just throw a big cross up in the sky for everybody to see so that every morning when they get up, they can look up in the sky and see this cross up there, and there it is. Why doesn't God do miracles every day and throw them in our face and punch us in the nose with miracles? Well, I believe that there is an answer to that, and I believe that God has a sovereign plan that is unfolding that really addresses that issue. And if I've got a few moments, I'd like to explain that. First of all, God has made himself overtly clear, but he's done that primarily during revelatory times. And what I mean by that is that there have been times in history in which God has revealed himself through prophets and apostles where he has virtually overwhelmed people with unbelievable miracles, like raising people from the dead and healing the sick and multiplying a few fish into enough food to feed thousands of people and so forth. But even in biblical times, we don't find one miracle after another. Rather, there's basically four basic periods of miracles: the time of Moses and Joshua, the time of Elijah and Elisha, the time of Daniel, and the time of Christ and the apostles. In between those times, we see that there's not that many miracles that take place. Now, here's my point. God did provide overt proof during revelatory times, during which God gave revelation, which was subsequently written down in scripture form. But even in biblical times when there wasn't revelation being given, God didn't give one miracle after another. So how much less should we expect one miracle after another in our day today? My point is that God has given overt proof.
Well, we lost Ron.
Pardon me?
Folks, we're having a little technical difficulty here due to our weather outside, and we'll get Ron Rhodes back here in just a second, and then we'll also continue our conversation with him on answering the objections of atheists, agnostics, and skeptics. In the meantime, let me remind you that our call-in number, 1-800-730-2727, 1-800-730-2727, and you can also access with questions or comments via our in-studio email address. It's issuesetc@kfuo.org. Dr. Ron Rhodes is with us. And with that little break, we're going to continue our conversation. Ron, when our sound cut out there momentarily, just a moment ago, you were addressing why God does not simply shower us with miracles every day. You said that there are periods of revelation where God has done this, but primarily long periods between where he hasn't made his existence that clearly, overtly evident. Please pick up where you left off. See if you can access Ron there again. Buzz. Ron, you there? All right, we'll try to get Ron back. Our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Now, coming up here in about 40 minutes or so, a little bit less, we're going to be talking with Dr. Martin Nolan. We're going to spend some time with him talking about Philip Melanchthon, who is the lesser-known but no less significant reformer of the 16th century, along with Martin Luther. Philip Melanchthon was a longtime friend of Luther's, but also, few know, author of a greater portion of these documents that make up the Lutheran Confessions, and no small lay theologian himself. Dr. Martin Nolan of the Concordia Historical Institute will be our guest to talk about that coming up in about 40 minutes. And then we'll round off today's program with an hour-long conversation. Terry Mattingly will be our guest. We'll talk about pop religion, pop culture, and how the two come together. Terry Mattingly from Scripps Howard News Service coming up in the third hour of Issues Etc. today. Ron, you back with us?
I'm back with you.
Good. You were in the middle of an answer, and I think you had pretty adequately covered why it is God doesn't simply slap us in the face with a daily miracle to prove that he exists. Here's another objection that we often hear. Look, if God is the beginning of all things, that is, if God were around before all of us were around, well, where did he have his beginning?
Yeah, that's a good one. You know, that's the old idea that if everything in the universe has a cause, then what caused God? You know, and it's important to understand, as a preface, what the law of causality is. Because the law of causality basically says that everything that was created has a cause. Everything that had a beginning had a cause. Now, obviously, that's a statement that doesn't apply to God, because God never had a beginning. This really kind of relates to the cosmological argument that says that, point number one, whatever had a beginning had a cause. Point number two, the universe had a beginning. Point number three, therefore, the universe had a cause. Now, God is the uncaused first cause, and that's not a cop-out on the part of Christians. That's not some kind of a trite, clever statement that we've come up with, but rather God is an eternal being. Before the creation, God eternally existed as Father, Son, and Holy Spirit in perfect fellowship with each other. And, you know, God did not create because he needed to create, as if he was lonely. I heard one theologian say that God was lonely and therefore created man. I don't think that's the case. I think that God sovereignly chose to create the universe for his own glory. But nevertheless, for all eternity, God existed in perfect fellowship with Father, Son, and Holy Spirit, and then he decreed to create the creation.
Now, that boggles the mind. I mean, don't we need to be willing to admit that to the skeptic, to the atheist, to the agnostic, that an infinitely existing, not a self-existing deity does boggle the mind, and reason cannot fully, while we can imagine, reason cannot fully grasp such a thing?
I think that it's true to say that reason cannot fully grasp such a thing, but it's not contrary to reason that such a thing exists. And that's the point that I would make to the atheist or to the skeptic. You know, very often they try to portray it as being an unreasonable belief on the part of Christians. And my point is that it's not an unreasonable belief. It may be beyond our reason to fully understand everything about our glorious God, but nevertheless, especially when you look at the evidences in our universe, it's becoming increasingly clear to numerous scientists that this universe did in fact have a beginning, and that there are all kinds of evidences that it was an intelligent designer who brought it into being. And that makes a great deal of sense to me. You know, so when I have an atheist tell me that I'm unreasonable, I like to take them back to the table and show them some of the scientific evidence and some of the, you know, the things that do seem reasonable. And quite frankly, there's a whole lot of atheists and scientists who are actually coming to faith today as a result of some of these evidences.
Well, you kind of take us to the issue of origins, to intelligent design, and to that theory of which it is making the greatest challenge, the theory of evolution. The skeptic might say, look, if you just look at basic human anatomy, compare it to the anatomy of other higher beings, vertebrates, you'll find such stark similarities, it's undeniable that these similarities in anatomy indicate a common origin, ergo an evolution from something simpler to what we have today in all its variety.
Well, you know, I've heard that one a million times too, and I agree that there is similar anatomy. I don't deny the skeptic that point. You know, I think that when you look at various creatures around the world, you do see many of them having eyes and noses and ears and stomachs and digestive tracts and brains and, you know, all those other similarities that exist. But I would answer the atheist objection by saying that these really point more to the same creator than to evolution. You might just use an example of some of the great painters that we've had in our history. For example, if you look at some of the paintings of Michelangelo or Da Vinci or Picasso, you can pretty much tell which painter did each painting because there are such similarities between their work. For example, if you look at Picasso, I mean, you can just look at some of the structures and some of the tones and some of the colors that he uses and tell that that's a Picasso painting. And in the same way, I think that the similarities that exist among the various creatures around the world point to the similarity from the common origin of the same creator. And when you think about it, human engineers do the same thing, don't they? I mean, when they look at the wheel, for example, they think to themselves, well, you know, the wheel would work really good on a car and on a bicycle and on a wagon and on a tricycle and buses and stuff like that. Same thing is true of light bulbs. Light bulbs work great in houses and buildings and cars and outdoor stadiums and street lamps and so forth. If human beings are smart enough to have a similarity in using a variety of different things in a similar way, why can't we say that God, the great designer, has designed each of us, all the different creatures of the world, with these eyes and ears and noses and so forth, because they fit a real role in helping those creatures adapt to their environment? You see, again, I think it all points to a common creator. I don't think there's any kind of substantive argument for evolution there.
What about those who say, and this is so common, we've heard it in court cases, we've read it in the newspaper of late as the intelligent design debate has heated up nationwide, Ron, and that is that intelligent design is junk science. It is, or it's creationism disguised as science, but in either case, there is no scientific basis for a theory of intelligent design. How do you respond?
Well, a lot of times, you know, they say it's religion in disguise, or other times I might bring up the idea that you can't really apply the scientific method to intelligent design. And, of course, the scientific method involves testing hypotheses, which involves observation and replication and so forth. And, of course, there's no way that you can replicate intelligent design in a laboratory, and therefore it must not be science. But, you know, there's a whole lot of areas of science in which repetition and replication is impossible. And I would just remind some of the atheists about, for example, the Big Bang Theory that many of them believe in. You know, that certainly cannot be replicated in any kind of laboratory. Nobody was there to see the thing happen if it happened. In the same way, and many atheists believe that fossils provide proof for evolution. But they weren't there to observe the fossilization process, and yet they do believe it's a part of science, can't be replicated in the laboratory. They weren't there to watch an alleged common ancestor between human beings and apes, split off, and then one of those groups evolved into human beings. They weren't there to see that, and yet they accept it as science. You know, my only point is that there's a lot of stuff in science that is not replicated. And the intelligent design of the universe would fall into that category. Now, having said that, I do believe that those, you know, scientists who do believe in intelligent design use a scientific method that focuses on contingency, complexity, and specification. I don't know if we have time to go into all that.
And I want you to do that because this is very helpful, the distinction you make in your book, answering the objections of atheists, agnostics, and skeptics between... It's really just it's a simple explanation of what information is. So take us into that, if you would. You've got a couple minutes here before the break.
Okay, well, when we talk about contingency as part of the method that is used, that refers to evidence. There is evidence that it did not result from an automatic, unintelligent process like, you know, natural selection. It doesn't depend upon anything else. If something were designed, we would expect to see evidence that it was also complex. In other words, it's got interacting parts. You might consider like a mouse trap that's got a spring and it's got a lever and it's got like a platform and it's got a number of parts that work together in order to function. So it's complex. And then finally, it's got specificity, meaning that it possesses a detailed, precise pattern which is commonly associated with intelligent causes. Now, I might illustrate it this way. If I just saw a bunch of random letters like W, Q, N, R, A, Z, well, that's a complex pattern, but it's not specific at all, is it? But if I looked up into the sky and I saw the words, concert in the park tonight, well, that's a complex pattern, but it's also very specific. You know, there's a message communicated there. And, you know, by using this kind of scientific method, we can detect evidence for an intelligent designer in our universe. By the way, there are many job professions and even industries that regularly use this same kind of scientific method. You know, one of the popular TV shows today is CSI, and that people might just pick up a hair off the ground and do a DNA analysis and find evidence for an intelligent design in terms of a murder that took place. You know, they examine the evidence and they look for signs of intelligence. Well, by using that same kind of science, we can detect very clear evidence that the entire universe was created by an intelligent designer.
I like your analogy with CSI or the kind of criminal forensics, because I think it kind of brings it home to people who may have never thought of it that way. You walk into a crime scene. How do you even know it's a crime scene in the first place?
Right.
You got a body. Maybe you got a little blood spatter. You might have a weapon lying nearby. You might have evidence of a struggle or breaking and entering or something like that. Okay. Individually, all these things might not amount to much, but you put them all together in one location, and a reasonable person says a crime was committed here, and they can even, if they have the expertise, Ron, they can even say, this is how this person died. Now, they won't say that they know who did it, but
right.
They will say a reasonable explanation of the facts as they're presented to us is that this happened in this way and that there was an intent and that this is the result of that intent. What we see here in front of us is a result of that intent. That seems to me the only case ID is ever trying to make.
Well, right. You know, and the thing of it is, I mean, it's not just CSI. I mean, you've got numerous other areas of, you know, job professions where you see this to be true. For example, my wife is a school teacher, and, you know, she came home one day and she asked me to look at two tests that were, you know, taken by some students. And it was amazing how similar they were. You know, when you look at it, you got the exact same mistakes and the exact same answers right. And even some of the wording was very similar. Now, was that by intelligent design or was that just a fluke accident? You know, that's what you look at. Now, any reasonable person, I think, that looks at the evidence would find evidence that there was an intelligent cheat in this case. And indeed, it turned out that that was the case. So teachers find evidence for intelligent design when they're grading papers. You've also got life insurance companies who, you know, they have these life insurance policies, and they want to find out if somebody was murdered or just died of natural causes, or was there some kind of deception going on that somebody just wanted to clean up and you know, claim somebody's insurance money. You know, so they're very interested in this whole issue of finding evidence for intelligent design. And, you know, humans have no problem accepting the scientific validity of applying science in these different areas, but still you got atheists who balk when it comes to the issue of proving an intelligent designer for the universe.
Ron Rhodes is our guest. We'll pick up on this subject on the other side of our break. He's president of Reasoning from the Scriptures Ministries. He's author of several books, including his latest, Answering the Objections of Atheists, Agnostics, and Skeptics. Our call-in number, 1-800-730-2727. We'll be giving away copies of Ron's new book to the best callers during this hour, 1-800-730-2727. And our in-studio email address, issuesetc@kfuo.org. We're talking about witnessing and answering the objections of atheists, agnostics, and skeptics with Dr. Ron Rhodes, president of Reasoning from the Scriptures Ministries, 1-800-730-2727. We'll be right back.
Defending the faith, teaching the truth. You're listening to Issues Etc.